Court. My name is William Shoemake. I represent the appellant Abilene Motor Express. At my counsel table is my co-counsel, Mr. Gabriel Walker. I would request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Three.
In this case, a couple of points following up on what was previously argued. First and foremost, there absolutely was evidence proffered that Mr. Butler was in fact fired. Is attached to the motion in limine on page 832 of the appendix, which was a supplementation of his original discovery responses. The response to the amended discovery was, I was fired from Abilene and Colonial Volvo. So if he had gotten on that stand...
Which contradicts his earlier interrogatory sworn statement that he voluntarily quit.
Exactly. And so at the very least, this was information that the jury was entitled to consider. As it relates to the retrial, I submit that the assignments of error deal with what the trial court did wrong or erred. That's what the assignments of error are designed to relate to. The question then comes, if this court finds error and you remand, to what do you remand? That's not an assignment of error. That's just the scope of any retrial, because if there's error, then there needs to be a new trial. That's why it's not specifically mentioned in the assignments of error. But if you look at the conclusion and the relief sought, it says a new trial with proper instructions to be given. So the whole point is, if you come into a case in which his employment history, which was a major component of this case, which led to a great deal of the damages, doesn't come in. And in fact, he has contradictory...
But Mr. Shoemake... Mm-hmm. The question that Justice Millett asked earlier is still on the table, which is a trial judge should be given an opportunity to rule right or wrong, you know, and given a clear statement of what the problem is. And the clear statement of the problem that was given to this trial judge is we need to put on our damages defense case and you're shutting us down completely. Please stop doing that. That was very clear, and the ruling was made. But correct me if I've overlooked it, but I don't see anywhere where counsel said, Your Honor, Put damage aside for a second. I need this for liability purposes.
Trial counsel did not do that. So if we were only looking to overturn the ruling based on credibility, that would clearly be a problem. But that's not where we are right now. Given that there should be a reversal, because the evidence should have come in for whatever reason, this court needs to decide, okay, what should be the scope of the trial? So once this court determines that there should be a new trial, what we're arguing is if you look at the evidence, if this had come in, it might have affected the liability as a practical matter. In addition, in the Bartholomew case, in the Gazette case, I believe, for example, the size of the verdict can have an impact on whether you retry a case as to damages or damages and liability. You look at all those factors in determining what the scope of the retrial should be. So we're simply pointing out, well, this could have had an impact on its credibility. So if it's reversed, it's only fair that it go forward on all issues. In addition, if you look at the size of the damages in this case, in which it was a misdemeanor assault and battery charge, in which a verdict was rendered for $450,000, and then another $450,000 in punitive damages on a case that was dismissed without a witness being called. That's an indication that there was bias and sympathy, especially when you combine it with the fact that this jury, with absolutely no evidence of respective financial conditions, hit Abilene Motor Express Company with 3.5 times the punitive damages that they hit the alleged perpetrator. And we would submit that shows a bias or sympathy in this case that would necessitate a retrial on all issues.
But your main point on punitives is that it wasn't pled properly and it certainly wasn't proved in terms of ratification and authorization.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. I was just pointing that out for the retrial issues. I don't necessarily think I should, unless the court wants further argument on why employment history in this case is relevant. On the other two issues, first on punitive damages, the trial court erred, as we've set out, when it failed to strike the punitive damages as related to Abilene Motor Express Company. This court has said in a long, long line of cases that while an employee, while an employer may be responsible vicariously for compensatory damages for what its agent or employee does in the scope of employment, there is a far different standard to impose punitive damages on the employer, because that's an entirely different issue. Punitive damages do not go to compensate or make someone whole. Punitive damages are designed to deter and to punish. And that public policy is not fulfilled by vicariously imposing punitive damages on an employer who wasn't controlling, ratifying, or authorizing the conduct of its employee. And this court has said that in Freeman versus Sproles, Hogg v. Plant, any number of cases. And that was argued on the motion to strike, and as trial counsel did, repeatedly brought it up. And the plaintiff never pled or alleged ratification or authorization in the complaint. It was never an issue in this case. And so, in responding to the motion to strike, I believe on page 201, the only argument Mr. Butler made in opposing the striking of the punitive damages as it relates to Abilene Motor was, Abilene Motor admitted the scope of employment, so therefore the punitive damage claim goes forward. That's our whole point. That is not enough.
When did the issue of ratification first insert itself in the trial?
It never did. I mean, that's part of our problem. Defense was, Abilene Motor was never put on notice that ratification authorization was an issue in the case.
So is that why there was no jury instruction?
That's what we presume. The court overruled this one. We cited Freeman versus Sproles. The court accepted the argument that ratification authorization wasn't necessary because they had admitted scope of employment. So it wasn't an issue in the case. And that's why, Your Honor, Abilene Motor didn't put on any evidence relating to the authority that Mr. Egan had or what they did in connection to the...
in any event, that's the burden of proof on authorization and ratification.
The plaintiff has the absolute burden of proof to prove authorization and ratification. It's part and parcel of their punitive damage claim. Just like they have to prove the intentionality and all the other elements. And this court has said that's what you have to prove. And I believe it was in Railway versus Deaton, Virginia Railroad Power versus Deaton, 147 Virginia 576, that they again, I think, upheld that position of there was no evidence of ratification or authorization, and therefore punitive damages could not be held against the employer. So it's one of the elements of the claim against Abilene Motor Express Company. And that's why, and it's a very high burden on punitive damages, obviously. And that's why, for example, under a pleading standard, there have to be a lot more specific facts as it relates to alleging punitive damages. So it was clearly the plaintiff's burden to prove ratification and authorization in this case. And at the very least, the defense is entitled to know that had been placed into issue. It was never alleged in the complaint. As this court said in Ted Lansing and other cases, you cannot pursue something that you never allege or never plead or never claim trial. So the other, as it relates to ratification, even if this court were to find somehow that was an issue in the case, there was absolutely no evidence of ratification as it or authorization as it relates to the defamation claim.
How did the owner respond to this immediately after the incident?
The only evidence on the record of what the owner did was that Mr. Butler called the president, I believe, Mr. Jones, and told him about the altercation and denied that he had assaulted Mr. Egan. The president promised to go and look at the tape. Then the next day, I believe, there was another conversation, and the president said, you know, I don't see any place where you assaulted Mr. Egan, and offered him a job back. Now, there were obviously job performances as his ability as a mechanic. I mean, he was going to be terminated irrespective of the malicious prosecution and defamation, but he was offered a job back as a truck driver, which is not evidence that you're trying to keep people off the premises or condoning it. And then the next evidence is that the case was dismissed with prejudice without a single witness being called. So there's no other...
disaffirmed as opposed to authorized or ratified what the employee had earlier done?
In terms of, I don't know in terms of, one, we should be on notice that that's an issue because we didn't call them because we didn't know ratification authorization was part of this case. But I don't know in terms of disaffirm, the only evidence is that, and I don't necessarily think they have a duty to disaffirm, but if you look at the evidence as to malicious prosecution, he has the conversation, and there's no evidence that Abilene ever did anything to further that prosecution or call any witness or have the contacts with the prosecutor or what those were, and it was dismissed, not just null prosecution, dismissed with prejudice. So in terms of this record, there is no action, there's no indication that Abilene did anything in furtherance of the action. And again, as to defamation, there's no evidence that there was even notice of about the defamation itself. As it relates to the security tape, I would just briefly say, again, we didn't put any evidence because we didn't know authorization was an issue, but there's also no evidence of, you know, who had access to a security tape or if it even was altered in any way.
That's the allegation on appeal is it was doctored.
But I don't see where that is, support one, supported in the record. But the second thing is there's no evidence about who had access to the tape, when it was done, whether it was done in connection with the malicious prosecution. In fact, the allegation by the plaintiff is that Egan was lying to his superiors. And our position was he wasn't the alter ego of the company. So they haven't established that any part of the management of Abilene Motor did anything in regards to the tape, and especially didn't do anything in regards to the tape as it relates to a malicious prosecution case where no evidence was introduced. It was just dismissed with prejudice. I would also note in terms of the issue of duplication of damages. In this case, this court has, in Wilkins versus Peninsula Motors, set forth a framework. And what this court has said is that a plaintiff is not required to elect between claims that have overlapping elements or damages. They are entitled to have both those claims put before a jury and be fully awarded on those damages. So that's why on the jury verdict form, you have separate spaces for the malicious prosecution and the defamation. I mean, the jury's not supposed to be dividing up the damages. The plaintiff is supposed to get full award for each claim. But what this court said in Wilkins versus Peninsula Motors is that it is therefore incumbent upon the trial judge to carefully review the verdict, since the plaintiff is allowed to put multiple theories for a substantially same recovery, to review it to make sure there's no double recovery of any type. And that's the balance that this court has made in being fair to the plaintiff and the defense.
So what should the trial court have done in this case?
It should have absolutely reduced the verdict. In this case, the plaintiff presented a gestalt of his damages. I think at the very least what the court should have done is eliminate the award as it relates to defamation, for example. I mean, if you look at, or split, or add them and split it, but if you look at it legally, the malicious prosecution is sort of the legal equivalent of defamation on steroids. Not only did you falsely state or make a claim, but you actually then pursued criminal charges attached to it. But I think the absolute result is to eliminate defamation because the plaintiff, or $200,000 of it, because the plaintiff never gave any suggestion other than the $1,200 attorney fee as it relates to the malicious prosecution.
Well, it's one thing to be defamed. It's another thing to be run through the criminal justice system, allegedly without any factual basis whatsoever.
And that's why I had suggested, if you were looking at it, the malicious prosecution count was, I think, $250,000. The defamation was $200,000. So if I were making a suggestion of what you would do, at the very least, then you would eliminate the defamation.
Why wouldn't you just tell a jury, you know, don't award duplicative damages and leave it to them? Can't they make that gut call every bit as good as you, me, or the trial judge?
Oh, I don't think you can do that under the law, because that's very dangerous. So, for example, let's say there are multiple theories. And in the multiple theory, it turns out one of them was invalid. So if you have a jury going around dividing the damages, and then on appeal, one of the theory gets kicked out, you've just divided the plaintiff's damages inappropriately. I think that's why in Peninsula, in the Wilkins case, this court has said the trial court has to be a gatekeeper. We're going to let the plaintiff, not elect. And so he can put them together, but the trial court has to then review it. And in this case...
Are you suggesting he would not be entitled to a damage award for the humiliation of being falsely arrested and having to go to trial, and the humiliation of being defamed to other people?
Well, if you look at the elements, for example, of injury to reputation, mental suffering, and when they were very substantially identical and put before the jury, my point is the plaintiff did not in his testimony in any way say the defamation caused me this much suffering and the malicious prosecution did this to me. In fact, if you look at the closing argument of Mr. Shields, as I quoted in my reply brief, he basically said to the jury, this is all one big thing. And the only issue is, do you believe Mr. Egan or do you believe Mr. Butler? And that was his argument. So there was never any attempt to try to divide it.
Well, it seems to me there may have been an attempt to try and divide it. If you look at Instruction 27 with regard to malicious prosecution and the same instruction with regard to defamation, it looks as if someone went through the typical model jury elements of potential damages and assigned some of them to malicious prosecution and some of them to actual damages. Would that be a correct read of how this jury was instructed?
Now, if you look at the give and take as it relates to the jury instructions, I believe defense counsel had pointed out on the malicious prosecution, there was no evidence of loss of business as opposed to lost wages. So I think that was stricken. But you'll also see on both instructions, it says to the jury, award all the damages that fully and fairly would compensate the plaintiff for the injury sustained, or something along that effect. Obviously, his whole claim for lost wages, for example, is that this harmed his reputation and he had to take lesser jobs as a result.
But if the court were to agree that the damage case has to be sent back for retrial because of the evidentiary errors, doesn't that moot this question of the duplicative nature?
Oh, it absolutely does, Your Honor. I mean, it absolutely does. Because it would, and as you pointed out, punitive damage, you can't punitive damages or anything else if you don't know what your compensatory damages are. So it would have to be set aside as to all damages. So this point would be moved if the court did that.
Well, lost wages are not relevant to punitive damages, and punitive damages does not appear to be one of the specific issues for one of the two defendants.
I'm sorry, I'm not following, Your Honor.
I mean, your punitive damage count, if yours fell because of lack of any evidence of authorization and ratification, the co-defendant doesn't have that issue, and the co-defendant arguably didn't even plead on appeal a challenge to the punitive damage verdict.
I think he, in thinking about it, took the position, which I think is correct. You can't have punitives without compensatory. You've got to know what your compensatory is. That's a necessary element that needs to be reviewed before you can award that. And I would say if you look at the IME financial case, I think, out of Chesterfield, where it says the record has to support what the trial court's doing. I think it's incumbent on this court, if it was just going to enter the award, to point out where in the record justified allowing both verdicts to stand completely without reducing a single dollar.
So you're saying it's just an abuse of discretion not to reduce it a little bit. You can't say what amount, but you're saying the trial court should reduce it some.
I'm saying at the very least they had to reduce some if you look at the overlapping damages.
That's a tough direction to give the trial court.
But I do believe it's almost like an indivisible injury. Thank you.
Mr. Shields.
Please the court. Again, I'm, of course, Bill Shields. I'm here for the plaintiff in this case. And I thought I would start off by revisiting this wage loss issue because I think that is probably the crux of what I'm hearing from the bench is first thing I've got to address. Remind the court that this is a case where we had a jury verdict. The judge approved the jury verdict, and she is entitled to have her decisions based on evidence, based on her discretion. It's an abuse of discretion standard when it comes to the admission of evidence. The issue about the financial transactions or the job history prior to Abilene, I'd like to just make 2 points on that. First of all, it would clearly be inadmissible to show the amount of money he was making as part of our wage loss claim, because it would show a higher average wage than he was making, and I don't think you can base your claim on a higher average wage than you were making at the job that you left. That was an issue. The second thing is, they admit that they wanted to show it to show his instability, in essence to cross-examine. The judge looked at the evidence, and I believe the judge is entitled to make the decision, that that evidence does not show what the defendant wants to show. It does not show instability. This shows a stable work record, and therefore it is inadmissible to try to show the unstable record that they wanted to show. So
did
I believe
the supplemental discovery that your client gave say that he was in fact fired from Volvo?
It does, and
so we have an interrogatory sworn answer that says, I wasn't fired. I voluntarily quit. Don't accuse me of that. Another supplemental answer that says, okay, I was fired. And then at trial, the defense can't say anything about that?
At trial, I think that it would have been misleading because the issue wasn't being fired from jobs in the first place.
Well, he said after he left their employment, he tried to get a job at Volvo, and that was in flux. And he was worried that was this all this problem that came up was part of the problem. And the defense just wanted to say that wasn't part of the problem. They actually fired him before. They're not going to hire him again. It has nothing to do with us.
But they also didn't offer anything from Volvo to say, okay, here's a witness from Volvo that's going to say what the situation over there was. And so I think in the absence of any proffer like that, her exclusion of the evidence was proper and appropriate. They just wanted to use it to, what they're saying here now is they just want to use it to beat him up, and I don't think that's a fair use of that evidence. Moving on to the ratification issue, I believe that the evidence shows that we pled that we clearly we accused both the company and the individual of these two causes of action. We claimed that all these actions taken by Egan were done within the scope of his employment. That was admitted. And it was admitted throughout the trial. There was one short bit of objection about ratification at the time of the motion to strike, not otherwise raised. The judge clearly tried the case on the idea that ratification was not an issue because the defense never pled any issue of ratification. They didn't raise it in their pleadings.
Well, if ratification were part of the burden of proof that a plaintiff has, a prima facie burden of proof, why would they need to say anything about it? Why can't they just wait till the end of the case and say, they have the burden of persuasion, I haven't heard any evidence of authorization or ratification, I move to strike the punitive?
Well, as I read the case of Commercial Business Systems versus Bell South, 249 Virginia 39, I believe that once an agency relationship is established, the burden is on the principal to show that an agent is not within the scope of his employment. And I believe that the greater weight of the principle, the way I believe it is applied in agency matters now, is that it is not whether the act itself is within the scope of the employment. The issue is whether or not the employee was working within the scope of his employment when he did whatever it was he did. It's not, you don't focus on did this act constitute part of the job. It's was he within his job when he was doing what he did. And I believe that's the case in, I believe it was, well, Commercial Systems, certainly one that I cited. We have several cases involving punitive damages where there is no discussion, at least, of ratification. For example, Martin versus Cavalier Hotels, 48 Fed 3rd, 1343. Cavalier Hotels was found liable in punitive damages, in a case in which there is no mention or discussion of ratification. The discussion is that he was a manager for Cavalier Hotels. He was in a position to control what this woman that he was abusing did. And so I think in that case that that there was a that punitive damages without proof of specific ratification being alleged by the plaintiff, I think it's proper. I guess what I'm trying to say, and sort of tripping over my tongue here, but I think what I'm saying is this. We pled agency. They admitted it. The whole case was tried that way. There wasn't a denial. There wasn't a claim ever. There was no attempt by the defendant to say, Abilene's not responsible for what Egan did. That came up after the case was over, with the exception of that one piece in the motion to strike. And I believe the evidence clearly is that he was acting within the scope. First of all, as a response. Excuse me.
Well, you said with the exception of the motion to strike.
In the motion to strike, there is one paragraph where they raise it kind of as an aside. Ratification, the judge just, you know, basically said, well, if you look at the instructions, and the argument, and the pleadings, they all say whatever is done by Egan is done by Abilene. They never tried to separate that out in any way, shape, or form during the trial. It was never an issue. They never denied that they were responsible for any of this. And I think that it forms a jury issue under commercial business, for example. I believe that where an employer has a burden of showing an employee is not acting within his scope, the site I gave you earlier, and if it's in doubt, there is a jury question for it.
Will you address the tape allegations also?
Well, I think this, that the claim against Egan, or the claim against Abilene, is based on two different things. Number one, the respondent superior, which is what I've sort of been talking about. And the second thing, his actual position. He was a supervisor. He says in his own words in the transcript that, I had complete control of the fleet in terms of maintenance. I hired, fired, I was completely in control of the fleet of trucks at this company. He also, the tape, the evidence clearly was, and it's he said that it was under the control of the company. His son, who was also a supervisor of the company, said it was under the control of the company. Egan, or the son, one, said in the transcript that they went to get to the box where the tapes are, to the camera, took the tapes out, and it was always under control of the company from that point on. And yet Jones and Egan, I think both Egans, admitted during the trial that the tape had gaps in it. There were things missing. So that clearly the tape was under the control of the company. Mr. Butler certainly never had any chance to get it. There's no evidence anybody else did, and the testimony in the appendix, in the transcript of this case, is that the company had control of it all the way. In terms of the company's actions also, Mr. Egan talked to Mr. Jones, who's the president of the company. Jones looked at the tape. Jones called up and said, look, I don't see where you did the things you're accused of. Offered him a job as a truck driver, they say, which by that time he'd been advised not to take because by his trial lawyer, by the criminal lawyer. But again, there's case law. I think Clark versus Montgomery Ward, 298 Fed 2nd, 346, 4th Circuit, 1962, I think, where you have evidence that a claim you're making in a malicious prosecution situation is not well-founded, you have a duty as the company to do something about it, to try to stop that from going forward. And they never did anything like that. They didn't try to stop the prosecution. In fact, at the conclusion of the prosecution, it looks like they got a kind of an agreement, which is in their pleadings, saying that Mr. Butler cannot come on Abilene's premises. If you look at their answers, just the answer to the case, it has that in there. I think it's paragraph 3 that they allege that the case ended favorably, did not end favorably for Butler because they were able to get this agreement that he won't come on the premises anymore. That shows the company was still involved in it long after they knew he was innocent of it.
How does that show the company? You look like you're waiting for a question. I'll ask one. How does that show?
I'm kind of running out of steam.
How does that show that the company was aware of it? Is there any evidence that anyone other than Mr. Egan even showed up on the date that this matter was null prost or dismissed or whatever happened? How do we know that the Commonwealth attorney just didn't decide, you know what, they probably don't want this guy back on their property? Judge, tell them not to go back on the property.
Justice Pallett may well be correct. But they chose to put it in their answer. And so I think it does show that certainly the company didn't stop the prosecution.
All right, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Shoemaker, you have 20 seconds.
Quickly, I think that's the issue. Respondeat superior. Scope of employment is different from ratification authorization, and that's the issue before the court. And then I would also note that he also indicated that Egan got the tape. And there's no evidence that the management knew anything about any alteration of any tape or otherwise. I see my time is up. Thank you for the pleasure to be here today.
Call the next case.